Hello, and welcome to Watch the Throne. What a lovely day. This is episode 24, North Country, from 2005. I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski. With us today, very special guest, prominent member in the Cage Club Podcast Network family, has not been on a Watch the Throne yet.
No.
It's Tobin Addington. Hello, Tobin.
Hey, guys. Well, I almost said welcome.
welcome.
glad to be here.
It only makes sense that you are on what is probably the number one candidate for a Contenders episode of a Charlize Theron movie to support your podcast of the Contenders, shining a light on the unruly women of cinema in a movie where it's Charlize Theron in the lead, a female director, a female screenwriter, a couple female producers. There are women in power all over this movie, and it's a movie about women's issues.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, this is on this was on our original list, not high on the list, but it was one we sort of had our eye on. So yeah, I'm glad to get a chance to talk about it.
Yeah, it's crazy, Joey, too. I was also thinking about Monster back when we did that, that might have been a contender for the Contenders as well. Kind of until I saw this movie, and this, I think, is much more in line with that. But also, like Monster, I feel like, while this is like a... I thought this movie was a really, really good movie, but it's one of those really good movies I don't know if I'm ever going to watch again.
Like Monster. I'm never going to see this again. No, absolutely not.
Like, it really affected me watching it this time. I don't know if I want to go through that again.
I also do want to point out that this, like Monster, were the two films that Charlize Theron was nominated for an Oscar for. She was nominated for her Oscar for Best Female in a Leading Role for this movie. She did not win. And Frances McDormand was nominated for Best Actress in a Supporting Role.
That's right.
I mean, she's great in everything, but I was so glad she was in this movie. This feels like almost a role tailor-made for her.
So I don't know if you remember, but that year, Reese Witherspoon won for Walk the Line, which we've talked about on past podcasts before. I don't remember if it's this one or other ones, but like with the biopics, I never know which way is the right way to say it. I don't need to see them because I know that Johnny Cash is an asshole. I don't need to see Walk the Line to learn that. So as good as she might be, I don't remember Walk the Line fondly. And then Rachel Weisz, who was just announced today, that she's pregnant with a Bond baby, she won for Constance Gardner over Frances McDormand. So there we go.
Yeah, and that I'm going to stand up for that entirely. She is one of my all-time favorite actresses and is incredible in that movie. You know, again, it's hard in these, like, you're putting actresses and actors against one another in these award shows, but I feel better about than maybe the Reese win. I love Reese Witherspoon, but that performance is good. That's a good performance, but I don't know.
And Frances, or I like to call it Franny McD, because she's just great, but she got her Oscar, right? She got that this year too. And funny enough, she in a movie also starring Woody Harrelson. So that was a strange connection.
Charlize was nominated for a bunch of other awards that year too, but she won two. She won at the Hollywood Film Awards. She won Actress of the Year, where there's no nominees, I guess. It's just you win.
Wait.
So like there's nobody she ran against. Joaquin Phoenix won for Actor of the Year that year.
Is that for their entire body of work? I guess that
it just
year,
lists.
Or just
so sometimes
movie?
On IMDb it lists like if there's multiple movies, but there it just says for this movie. Okay. So I'm not sure if it includes other things or not. But in 2005, the only other movie that she did was Aeon Flux, which we have not seen yet. But I can imagine that that's probably not up for Oscar or awards talk.
The award I think it's up for mostly is the Razzie, right? I mean, I haven't seen it. I'm really looking forward to it.
Or possibly Mike's favorite Charlize movie to date.
We'll see. Yeah, it's we're gonna get there.
That happens sometimes when they give with no other nominees a Best of the Year award. Sometimes they give that to people just to get them to come to the awards show so that they can have that be part of the draw to come see somebody get an award. So I don't know if that's the case here, but that's possible.
You know, real quick, if I can, just because I love this guy's work, but Adam Rifkin just came out with a new movie starring Burt Reynolds, and that is the exact plot, that he gets invited to this festival he's never heard of, but they're giving him a lifetime Achievement Award, and when he shows up, it's basically in a bar in Austin, Texas, and the movie's about him reflecting on his career and accepting his place and stuff. But yeah, I mean, that must happen. It must have been based on a true story for someone.
Love it. The other award that she won that year was at the Women Film Critics Circle Awards, where she won Best Actress for this movie. Again, no other nominees. But what I love about this, just looking at it, is there's also a Best Animated Female category, which went to Helena Bonham Carter for Corpse Bride. So I think that's just a super cool, category.
Yeah.
Best Animated Female.
I love that movie. That movie's awesome. It's gorgeous. I think it's a little crazier than Nightmare Before Christmas. The two of those get lumped together. I might have the edge, but sorry, continue. So many diversions here in the opening. Yeah.
So this movie, North Country, is about the North Country, which is Minnesota. I took great offense to the villains of the movie bringing up my Minnesota Vikings in the middle of the movie talking about a girl quarterback. I was like, do not bring them into this. Do not sully their name with this. But it's about the first sexual harassment case in the early 90s that Charlize and her eventual co-workers lead this class action lawsuit against this mining company, this coal mining company.
Steel. Isn't it steel?
Is it steel?
I'm not sure. They keep saying American steel, and like they keep talking about the president is allowing cheap steel and steel, but so I wasn't really clear though.
They don't, like, she never actually mines things. Like, she cleans up what they call the powder room. She does a bunch of different stuff while at work. Mostly she gets sexually harassed, but she never actually mines things from what I remember or what we see, right. So I wasn't exactly sure. But is it steel or is it coal? Or is it just something sort of generic mining?
I'm way out of my depth here, but my
all three of us.
my understanding is that they are mining ore in order to make steel.
Okay. So it's like half and half.
I'm not the science guy. So
no, the extent of my steel knowledge or mining knowledge for that matter comes from the Keanu film Prince of Pennsylvania. So I was getting some parallels in the beginning, but that was only in the beginning.
But I want to ask right off the bat, because this sort of sat with me a little bit strange, that this is a movie that stars Charlize Theron, where she is great in it. She's the lead of this. She's a single mother, which I love, which we're going to get to in a little bit. Her father is played by Richard Jenkins, and he undergoes this transformation in this movie, where he sort of, the first line he says to Charlize, to his daughter, when she shows up to his house beaten and bloodied, is, "Did your husband catch you with another man? Is that why he laid hands on you?" Oh, this is exactly who this guy is. He's a monster. He's terrible. He undergoes this transformation from that kind of guy to ultimately standing up for his daughter, literally in the court of law, but also literally and sort of metaphorically at the union meeting.
Right.
But my question to both of you is, does it feel weird in a movie that's ostensibly about female empowerment to essentially give the moment in the movie to Richard Jenkins?
Oh.
And that moment, just for the listener, that moment is after Charlize is at the union meeting.
Yeah.
And she sort of has her time, which apparently there's a time limit for her and nobody else. Richard Jenkins then goes up and sort of finishes what she started.
Yeah.
And that is like the moment in the movie. And it felt to me weird that in this movie about strong women and about women standing up for themselves, that the speech that people are going to remember comes from Richard Jenkins.
Yeah. Let me just start by saying, well, I like this movie and I think it's a good film. It does have problems. And that to me is one of the problems. I wrote down in my notes, dad is literally standing up for his daughter, like stands up in the crowd and says like all this stuff like about like, don't say that to my daughter. And then I wrote, one speech by one man can do it. You know, like it really kind of bothered me that up until this moment, it was all her. And then a guy sort of had to come in and swoop and steal the moment of glory like that. That was, I feel, sort of a fault of this movie. I mean, I got so much, there's so much more to unpack about this. I didn't know we were jumping straight to that moment.
Well, that was the biggest thing that came to me. Like, I know that we jump really to the heart of the matter here.
Yeah.
That we gloss over so much, but it just struck a chord with me. And also the similarly, when they're in the courtroom, Woody Harrelson has his moment.
Yes.
Where he's screaming at Hawkeye. He's like, red or yellow, red or yellow. And I'm like, that feels too like that's his moment.
Yeah.
And Charlize has a lot of really good moments, but it feels like the two biggest ones in this movie, again, a movie about women standing up for themselves, are both from men.
Yeah.
And it's a little sad.
The courtroom thing, I noticed that a little less, I guess, because the women end up standing up at the end of that. But definitely during the union meeting, I was like, this is a moment where Charlize should be screaming and the women should be like sort of standing up with her, and her dad like should just sort of be sitting there in shame, I guess, like, should not have taken the mic. So long answer short, that did bother me.
It's possible, too, that they're hewing to what actually happened. This is based on a not just a true story, but I believe a book, a nonfiction book about the events. And I think they're obviously making changes. And it does feel like if you're not, if they want to save the women standing up for the courtroom, then maybe at the union meeting, maybe Richard Jenkins, you see his turn as he quiets the crowd and then gives the mic back to her and allows her to finish her speech. Like, I do agree there's her moments don't come in sort of the hero moments of the movie. It's interesting to match this to a movie we talked about on Cinemakers, Aaron Brockovich, another sort of, you know, kind of courtroom drama, a woman down on her luck standing up for herself, having to find ways to sort of discover new skills and all this and operate in a world that is predominated by men. And it feels like they are able to give her, Aaron Brockovich, Julia Roberts, those moments in that movie in a way that it does feel in the climax that they kind of miss that a little bit for Charlize. I think that's true.
I'm glad you brought up Aaron Brockovich, because when this movie starts and we see sort of a single mom doing it for herself and, like, you know, she's in charge and she's working for herself, and we don't know exactly, like, what her scenario is, and it's also related to the law and related to the courtrooms. So I was like, oh, Aaron Brockovich. And then I sort of lose that thread as the movie goes on a little bit, but I'm glad that you mentioned it because it did give me those vibes really early on. I do also want to say, Mike, that, like, it feels like more prominent than any other setting for any Charlize movie, she's always finding herself in courtrooms.
That's funny. I wrote down court, and I also wrote down accent, because I've feel like I don't even know what her real voice is anymore. Like, she has used that less than an accent in the whatever number of movies we've watched by now, but the average of there is high.
This is, you know, it's obviously a Minnesota accent. Apparently they didn't do a dialect coach. They just went to local bars and talked to locals and figured out how to speak like them. But you're like, I didn't think about the accent because the really only thought that I gave to the accent is like, oh, Frances McDormand is back from Fargo. Like, that just, mm-hmm. you know, that's what I, you know, yeah, what I mean? Yeah. But a lot of, like, everybody's speaking. I think everybody's, for the most part, doing pretty well. Or if somebody wasn't, I sort of was able to block it out and not be bothered by it.
They're being subtle about it. They're not doing the full Fargo. And I think that was smart in this case.
I don't get it at all from Woody. I don't expect it from him either, really. I just feel like he's sort of in a class by himself. Not that he's, like, a better actor or anything. I just feel like his niche is to be Woody Harrelson in movies and stuff. And, like, I wasn't expecting him to really disguise himself with an action. But, like, you know, when Sean Bean, who's a Brit, right? Like, he's a British guy. Like, when he sort of slides into it, I'm like, oh, okay, this dude, he actually, and I'm glad he doesn't die. It's, like, one of the few movies where he doesn't die. Like, this and National Treasure.
Just real quick. So, on IMDb, that's a piece of trivia that he doesn't die. And 47 of 50 people found this interesting. Like, he's so known to die that when he doesn't, it's like this, like, celebratory event.
Yeah, and he's great in it. He's like the only he's like the only guy I'm cheering for, because, like, even Woody has a moment where she's like, so you're only doing this because it's never been done before, and he looks her dead in the eye and is like, yeah, that's about it. Like, I don't really care about, like, the issue. I just care about the fame or whatever and stuff. I've got more to say about that character later, but, like, I don't know. I quite liked all the actors here. I think everybody's doing a good job in whatever role they have. And I quite like the sort of fractured time structure. They didn't go overboard with that, but some of the reveals were good. I definitely thought Hawkeye was the father. Turned out not to be. You know, stuff like that was kind of clever.
Yeah, Hawkeye's a real piece of shit in this
movie. Oh, my God, dude. Like, yes. Was this before Hurt Locker? Because I've only heard of Jeremy Renner from Hurt Locker. That was the first time I heard of him. But to think that he was throwing down performances like this, and I hadn't heard of him, like, I feel kind of ashamed myself not to be up on him. It's like, oh man, like, he is so crazy in this movie.
This was 2 years before Hurt Locker, so there's a chance that you know, Kathryn Bigelow or casting directors or whoever saw him in this movie and was like, oh, we can do, like, he can do this, like, he can carry a movie. And I mean, obviously we've seen him go on to do things, like, he's great in Wind River, he's good in The Town, which is, like, a different kind of, like, local sort of blue-collar community, but similar in a lot of ways. But he's apparently been acting since like 95, it looks like. So he was a decade into his career by this point when this movie came out.
He had a big break in a movie called Dahmer, where he plays a young Jeffrey Dahmer.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Oh. And I can't remember if it was a TV movie or a movie. I can't remember. But that was sort of the thing that, and it wasn't his first movie role, but there'd been a lot of TV before that, I think. My memory is that people had a hard time figuring out what to do with him after that. Like, he's apparently very good in, I think I've seen that, but he's apparently very good in it, but people don't know what to do with you after you've been sort of Dahmer and Jeffrey Dahmer. So,
yeah,
you know, it took a while to sort of find his place. But I had the same kind of experience. I forgot that I'd seen this movie when it was in the theater, and I forgot that he was in it, and I forgot that Richard Jenkins was in it. I forgot a lot of people were in it. In both for Jeremy Renner and for Richard Jenkins, I had the feeling of when they showed up on screen, I thought, okay, here's our chance to see, were they always as good as we think of them now, and we just weren't aware of it? Were they always turning in those kind of level of performances? And I think for both those guys, it's true. I think they're both awfully good in this movie. And I think that, but it's interesting to think about where it fits in his career.
Talking about, just quickly, about Richard Jenkins, I was asking you guys before we started recording about Bill Nighy, and he said that in an interview that he regards Richard Jenkins' performance in this film as one of the finest in motion picture history, which is very wow. high praise, obviously. And I read that before I started watching it, and for a while, I guess you can sort of sense that there's going to be he's going to come around to see the light, if you will. You know, knowing that, I was watching his performance, he's not in the movie a ton, and he's sort of just like shuffling around in the background, and you see that he is sort of, in a way, like, eventually sort of giving into the family, and, you know, he hates this, what he doesn't know is a rape grandchild, right? Because I got the impression, I'm sorry, I'm all over the place, no. But I got the impression that when she admits in the courtroom that it's a rape baby, like, she had never told anybody, right? Is that the impression that you guys got?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the impression I got.
He just thinks that this grandson of his is like this bastard from who knows where he came from, and is disgusted with his daughter because of it. And as the movie goes on, he sort of, you know, becomes a little bit more involved and goes to the son's hockey, or the grandson's hockey game, and all this different stuff. And he's a little bit more active and a little bit, like, he's sort of softening a little bit, but I still wasn't seeing it. And then we get to the court, the union scene, and then we get, like, beyond that, like we talked about, and it's just, oh, there's that performance shining through. But what I do want to say is that, like, you know, he's always been, not only has he always been good, but he always has apparently looked the exact same. Like, he looks the same in 2006 as he does in 2018.
The one thing about this performance of his in particular that struck me is that, up to this point anyway, I haven't seen all of his films, but it's very much unlike the type of character I've seen him play before. Like, I see him as a great character actor, but he's mostly playing nice guys, or, I don't know, most recently I think of Shape of Water, you know, like that type of role, or Burn After Reading, where he's not really, like, the take charge type of guy all the time or anything, but he's also, I've never seen him so scary or mean or have that weight of that anger or whatever.
Yeah,
he's
cruel.
All that,
he's not usually so cruel.
Cruel, yeah, that cruelty. I mean, even like that, what he's, you know, he's horrible towards his own blood, his own daughter. And I feel like the character is well written in the sense that he has like these micro revelations throughout the movie that he doesn't even want to acknowledge until that scene in the end where it's just like all comes to him. You know, he finds a way to express himself that everyone will understand, with that sort of talking about at the picnic, we don't talk to each other's wives and daughters like this. And he's like, well, my daughter is working here right with us, so what's, you know, like, what's the difference? Like, I really bought that moment up until then when he turns and he comes through and everything. And I actually didn't expect it exactly at that moment. I thought he was going to walk out of the meeting, to be quite honest. And then I thought we were going to get that, you know, in between or later on, or I knew we would get that moment. I just wasn't sure when, but yeah, it definitely pays off big time.
And I feel like that's sort of weird about this movie, in that it's ultimately kind of predictable, but you also don't know when the things that you know are going to happen are actually going to happen.
Yeah, because that moment kind of stole the thunder from Charlize, right? Like, his moment came, but it was in the way of hers or something. It seemed sort of off-timed or something.
Yeah, something doesn't quite work in this movie. It seems like it has, and I remember this from the very first time I saw it, it seems like it has all the things that it needs. It seems, and for me, it's going to scratch the itch of the Aaron Brockovich. Like, I love that kind of movie, a person standing up against the system, and especially in this context where you have this woman who's sort of at long last standing up for herself and other women in this way. It's got great actors. It's full of great performances. Yeah, it's hard to know what it feels like. There are a few enough small things that don't quite work. That then, yeah, it doesn't quite hang together for me.
Part of it I feel what you're saying, Tobin, because I think that's why I didn't give it like 4 or 5 stars. I've been down more to like 3, 3.5 or something on this, because it's all there and most of it's executed really well. There's just like certain times where it feels like it's off track. Maybe some of that comes from the fictionalized version. You're trying to maybe adapt or jam so much into it. I mean, I don't know what's harder, fictionalizing a true life story or adapting a true life event or adapting a book, or you know what I'm saying? Like, I feel like you run into different types of problems, but you still got problems about an uneven plot or tone or things like that might come through. So I don't know if maybe something like that could have been ironed out. Maybe the focus needed to be a little more Charlize only. I don't know. Another thing about this, that it's just like, as a man, you know, watching this movie, I feel like shit, and like rightfully too. I feel, you know, like the men in this movie, I feel like as bad as we saw, they're probably 100 times worse to these women. That is very effective watching this. Like, I feel all that come through on the screen. So like, while I say it's a good movie, like I don't know if I want to has a much rewatchability to it because of stuff like that. But it is effective in that manner. I think that's where a lot of my stars come from, is like, oh, this is really making me like react.
All of the things that happened in this movie actually happened to women in real life. That there was a bit of trivia on IMDb that said all the harassment depicted in the movie really happened to various women. 2 women were trapped in porta potties that were tipped while they were inside. Side note, the inside of this porta potty was made of Gatorade, Cocoa Puffs, and pumpkin pie filling. So as gross as it is in real life and gross as it looks in the movie, kind of a delicious concoction for this. But minors ejaculated onto female minors' clothes and lockers 3 times, and many more incidents of harassment occurred than can be shown in a 2-hour movie. So you're absolutely right, Mike. Like, you know, what we see here is like despicable and gross and terrible. At the same time, it's like the tip of the iceberg, probably.
Yeah. Maybe it's an unfair comparison to be comparing it to Aaron Brockovich, but I think what it ultimately is for me, because since it has all these great performances and good actors and these strong images, as you've just talked about, I mean, these things are sort of horrific to watch. I think maybe it's in the filmmaking itself, like internally within the scenes. I don't feel like the filmmaking is doing much more, like the shot-to-shot filmmaking is doing much more than capturing the performances. And that's fine, but you think about the way that Soderbergh is, you know, using his camera and his editing in Aaron Brockovich and getting into her point of view in a way that this feels a little bit more, and I don't mean this entirely in a pejorative way, but a little bit more like a late 90s TV movie where because it's a small budget and they have to race through it and they have so much to get, and so you just kind of get what you can and concentrate on getting the performances. But as a result then, and maybe then also add to that the idea that they're leaving out some of, they're not giving Charlize the kind of hero moments at the end, what you're left with is it just doesn't quite pack the wallop that you're hoping or expecting it to.
You know, I actually thought about Soderbergh once or twice watching this, because I like how he sort of explores a community in a way. Like we were talking about with Mosaic, how he really like used the murder mystery backdrop to explore like the affluent community, that ski community that where it was taking place. And he's done that before. I felt like this movie could have done a lot more of that and didn't take advantage. Like that's one thing. Another thing is, as far as like actual filmmaking like goes, like there is just so many aerial shots of like the mine and the mine and then the mine again and then the mine. Like there's kind of a redundant sort of quality to the filmmaking itself in this. Like you're right, it's not really standing out and trying to do anything more with the shots really. I only really found one instance where there was any kind of like anything to really decode in a shot or any, like I was looking, you know. And there's just one moment when she meets Woody Harrelson, I think they're talking at the hockey match, he's wearing like a black shirt and the collar's open a little and he's got a white shirt underneath, so it makes him look like a priest. And I was like, oh, this movie's like doing everything it can to say this is a good guy, like subconsciously, just so you know, immediately, like he's not going to be a dickhead like everyone else. Like he literally looked like a priest in that shot. And I was like, okay, I'm going to look for little clues. Like, is the movie tipping its hat in any other ways? And no, I don't really think it was. So that could be a thing, that it's just visually not doing more than it could, or taking advantage of stuff that way.
Now, does that fall on the director, or does that fall on the set design, or like, is that the props department? Like, is that everything? Like, what is it about, like, who sort of didn't fully tell the story the way it could have been told?
I just think there's a lack of visual metaphor in this movie. Not to keep using Soderbergh, but you think about a movie I like that you didn't as much. Think about Bubble and the way that what they did at that factory with the dolls and the way that they were presented around that machinery underscored what was going on. And in this case, you do get shots of her working. You get shots of her scraping stuff down. It's really muddy. But like, I wanted to sort of get in there and feel like what it was feeling like, you know, not necessarily the harassment stuff, because I think you do get some of that. Yeah, I think ultimately it comes down to the director sort of leading the whole team to sort of say, okay, if you're doing this in props, then we're going to capture it this way with the camera, and we're going to find ways to sort of underscore, or Mike, as you're saying, sort of give the audience clues and things to things that are going on underneath what we're seeing. It just kind of presents it all as text in a way, and I think that as a result, there's some moments that really stand out where performances do emerge in a way in smaller moments, but there's nothing else sort of holding that up, I think.
Yeah, I think though what this does have sort of keeping it together and holding it up in a way is the subject matter, right? Like that, yeah. I feel like that carries a lot of weight. That goes a long distance. So I feel like it handles that really well. And like you said, Tobin, like I feel the harassment, but yeah, you're right. I don't really feel the rest of it as much.
And I think the other thing that's holding it up is just Charlize's performance in the center of all this. Like, she's really good. Yeah. Not to, again, compare it to Monster like we were at the top, but like, we are firmly in the stage of her career where she can fully carry a movie. It just happens to be, once again, a movie that I don't want to see again. I do think that two of her best performances, and I mean, obviously, according to the Academy, are like this and Monster, and it's almost like you can't recommend either movie because like, you don't want to make, like, you can't recommend either without being like, hey, so, just so you know, it gets real, real heavy. Yeah. You might be depressed, but she's really good in it. And I want to find more movies that are like fun and good and like, you know, the equivalent of like a Man of Tai Chi or like a Flying or something, where it's just like, hey, the movie, like, it won't take anything out of you, and Keanu's great in it or whatever. But here it's like, yeah, if you want to be like real depressed and like sort of hate all men, yeah, she's great in this, but good luck.
Yeah, and that's the thing too. It's like right from the jump, it's heavy, and it never lets up. Like the opening scene,
yeah, right.
She gets beaten by her husband, and they leave, and that's the cold open. You know, like the pre-credits, she gets punched in the face by her husband and leaves him. Like, it never gets, there's no levity. Like, maybe there's a moment or two with Franny McD, because I love her. You know, that character who gets Lou Gehrig's disease, for Christ's sake, like, is, you know, the strongest of the strong. And just because of the virtue of her character, always sort of seeing the bright side and that kind of thing. Like, thank goodness, you know, a minor moment of that was in this movie. But yeah,
a minor moment.
But I'm bummed.
but yeah, because this is very heavy. This is a heavy drama, serious retelling of serious events and stuff. So you're right. This sort of has like a bumper warning on it.
Yeah, it is kind of oppressive, the overall tone, or at least relentless in that way. And maybe it could have there could have been more levity. When you do get it from Frances McDormand, it's often very dark because it's after she. I guess there's some before, but also after she has been diagnosed and we know what's going on with her and she's losing control of her body. And she is very darkly funny in those moments, but she's also losing control of her body, which makes that hard to watch. And I'm not saying all this to say this is a bad movie. It's not bad. It just, it feels like a pretty good movie that could have been great, or like a well-made movie that isn't, that had all this potential to be something more than that. And I don't think it transcends itself.
It's just less than the sum of its parts. Like, yes, I don't think there's anything bad in here. It just doesn't gel together. One thing that I did like, and it brings us back to maybe the darkest moment in the entire movie, we get, for the first time, young Charlize. And not only do we get young Charlize...
We had her. Didn't she visit a fortune teller as a child?
Right. In Head in the Clouds.
Head in the Clouds, yeah.
Yes. But the more notable thing, I don't know if you recognized her, that is Amber Heard.
No.
Yes.
I did not pick that up. Wow.
I'm telling Cage you, Club everybody's Award in winner. This movie. Everybody's in this movie.
That's incredible.
Cage Club Award winner for Best Non-Cage Role Female from Drive Angry 3D. I do
terrific.
Feel like she, either A, I don't know what she looks like, or B, she just, something changed where she like looks different now than she did then. Because I've seen her young in a couple of movies, and it's always weird. Like, I don't recognize her immediately. And I looked up, I'm like, oh, who plays young Josie? It's like, oh my God, okay. Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe I just don't know what she looks like. Maybe that's my problem.
No. There's a thing I feel, I don't know how old she is in this movie, but I know, it's funny. It's like, you don't see sort of like a, not a child actor, but like a teen actor or something like that for a little while. And then like, they just appear like on the Tonight Show and they're adults suddenly, and they look so drastically different. And you're like, holy shit, I have to like rewire my brain. I mean, and like, that's what Elle Fanning looks like now, because she's like, you know, an adult. I'm so used to seeing her as a little kid or whatever and stuff. So that sometimes comes into play, you know. Just quickly going back to, like, I wonder, you know, if this wasn't such a sort of star-studded, quote-unquote, like, Hollywood, you know, because this feels like the Hollywood version of this story. I wonder if this was on a more shoestring budget, if they could have gotten, you know, maybe a little tighter. I don't want them. I mean, it goes dark, but like, you know, maybe they could have found something else in there with the focus, as opposed to like some of the moments. Maybe I'm getting at what I'm getting at is some of the moments feel very contrived that you would get in a movie that's sort of Oscar bait or trying to appeal to the, you know, to the masses. Like, if that was removed, that element from this, like, I feel like the studio wasn't so sort of like looming over this in a way. I feel like there's your version, like, right there. Like, and maybe it would not be, I mean, it would probably be just as oppressive. Like, I think that's part of the point. Like, we're only experiencing like a fraction of what people go through all day long, just, and we're just watching a 2-hour movie of it. So I think that might be a little more of the point, but like, I do feel like maybe it's just too big, like, in general, you know. If they just stripped it down a little more, they could have found like the core there.
Well, I think they tried to strip it down. I think they just try to focus on mostly on Charlize, but it also sort of bleeds over into her coworkers, also including, we did not mention her name yet, Michelle Monaghan in this movie is so good.
Yeah, another true detective with Woody Harrelson, so there's another Harrelson connection.
Hell yeah. Oh, also, I want to say, I just scrolled by him in my notes, Timothy Spall is in this movie too, the guy from House of Cards and from
Ant-Man. So Yellowjacket and Hawkeye are in this, and then they're not in suits, and it's like 10 years before they join the MCU. It's crazy.
Corey Stoll.
Also in this movie, Hank Jennings from Twin Peaks.
Yes, Chris Mulkey.
He is in this. And also, I thought it was funny that there is a character, I think, Richard Jenkins and Charlize are named Hank and Josie, and that's other Twin Peaks character names. So I'm just like, this is a very weird Twin Peaks connection.
Good call. Yeah, Corey Stoll's in the movie. Oh, House of Cards, is that the guy you were talking about?
Yeah, I said Timothy Spall. Corey Stoll. That's who I meant. Yes.
Yeah.
The bald guy.
Who's that? What was that show on FX with the weirdo zombie invasion?
The Strain,
yes.
Oh, the vampire zombies or something.
Yeah.
The Guillermo del Toro thing, yeah. Xander Berkeley is in this too, as one of her sort of immediate supervisor, who I always think of as, for 24, he was... I can't remember if he was good or bad or what happened to him, but he's been in a million things. It's the same kind of small character actor thing, and he puts on, he's got a little ham going on with his accent and his big mustache and stuff.
Oh, but, that big mustache, yeah.
But he's always fun to see.
While we're just naming names, Sissy Spacek, too.
Yeah, of course,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, one thing that was kind of, I didn't realize I wanted it until I realized I was missing it, but like at the very end, when like women or people, like everyone starts standing up and it's like, well, who's that person? Where's that woman? Like, I don't remember this person in the movie the whole time. Like, there's something, then it occurred to me, like, we're only seeing like 5 or 6 of these women, right? And there's like, how many are there supposed to be? Like 13 or 14 or something? Or that, yeah. I didn't realize I was missing out. Like, I wish I could have seen maybe, like, because Joey just mentioned, you know, we sort of branch out in the middle a little bit and we sort of follow this for a thread or something, and you know, Frances McDormand definitely has her thread, so like, it would have been cool maybe to see a little more of that. Like, that's another way we could have focused, different direction. I mean, again, I don't know why I'm trying to fix a movie that I like necessarily, but I mean, just saying, like, it would have been interesting to see a little more of that explored, since that is what so much of the focus is on. Like, we get the Tupperware, not a Tupperware party, but like a
Mary Kay Cosmetics kind
of thing. Yeah. Like, I feel like they tried to sneak some of it into that scene, but they had to also compromise and make it, you know, a scene about earning extra income and everything like that. So, I mean, again, there's flourishes there, but I see those flourishes and I'm like, oh, I wish that was just like more. I wish that was just more than
well,
just
also another reason why you might not have recognized women standing up in the courtroom at the end is because a lot of the people, or not maybe a lot of people, but a handful of the women standing up were actual plaintiffs in the real life case.
Oh, interesting.
So they're not women from the movie, they're women from that this was based on.
Huh.
I guess that, okay, that makes a little more sense now. It's like, okay, the end of the movie, let's like try and, yeah, I see what they were doing there. But then again, that's like an Oscar moment, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's not, like, to me, that's not working for the story, because I'm like, well, who is this person? Where did she come from? I never seen her before.
Right. And you know what I was thinking of, Mike, in terms of like Oscar moments and in terms of like powerful endings in courtrooms, what works, I think, better, what I think I'm going to remember more than Red or Yellow is the Gimme 10 Steps from Men of Honor.
Yeah. Well, Men of Honor is just a great, it's a different movie, but I like that movie more. I think that has less flaws, but you're right, like that resonates more. This, the stuff between Woody and Hawkeye is just, I was like, where is this going? Like, why is this suddenly their movie? And that little strange. They went very in on that.
And I think the problem with this comes from something else that I read on IMDb, was that like, for the sake of the movie, they condensed like a bunch of trials into one trial.
Yeah. Oh, good.
It makes sense within the scope of the movie that we're not going from courtroom to courtroom and trial to trial. Like, everything's just in one, that it goes from being, you know, her trial to the class action lawsuit, all this different stuff. It does feel, though, when you do it like that, that like Jeremy Renner gets broken down from like this bravado guy to nothing in a matter of like 45 seconds just because he has his manhood called out. Like, that felt obvious? I don't know if that's the right word, but you know what I mean? Yeah. It's just like,
it's too easy. The whole courtroom scene is poppycock. There's just nothing in there that, like, that's part of it for me too, is that, and that's in, I blame the writing as much as the directing in that, that I just think that they haven't, by bending reality so much, I'm not buying it. I do want to mention, though, there were a couple places, now that I think of it, where we were more in her perspective that I think worked really well. One of them is that before
Perez and Charlize?
Yes, sorry, in Charlize's point of view. One of them in based on where the camera was, I'm thinking about in scene camera work that works in this movie that I think there should have been more of. There's one moment where before she has the job at the mine, she's having a gynecological exam, and we see it shot from her point of view, looking up at her knees out over the top of her gown, and then the doctor comes out and says, "Oh, it looks all good," or whatever, and then you realize that she's having it done at the behest of the company. They have to know she's not pregnant before they hire her. The sense of violation and, the ugh is just exactly what I think you're supposed to be feeling in that moment. And it's captured really well through not just having, oh, okay, here's what's going on, but putting us in her point of view first, and then in the course of the scene revealing the insidious nature of what's actually happening. And by doing that, that moment then resonates more than a lot of the other moments in the movies. I wish there had been more of things like that.
And there was one other little moment in that scene, and I don't know if it was just sort of weird set decoration or placement or if it was actually how it was, but like the doctor does his examination, writes down his notes or whatever, hands her the box of tissues, then goes to leave and like basically opens the door onto her legs. You know what I mean? Like her legs are just basically pointed at the door, and it's just like, oh, that's like, that's terrible. And I don't know if that's like, you know, I don't know if that's normal, because I know that probably in most, well, I don't know about most doctor's offices, maybe you don't have the table facing the door so that like anybody walking by can get like an upskirt shot of like any it's just, whether that's intentional or unintentional, just like another layer of violation that I was like, ugh.
Yeah, that I think what that sequence did really well was it just definitely disoriented me, because I had to take a moment and go, wait a minute, she's not at her doctor, she's at the company doctor right now. And that's hammered home in the next scene when she shows up for work and the fucking foreman is like, hey, Doc said you look great under them clothes. Right. I'm like, holy shit. Like, it's already started. Like, again.
Rulo numero uno. Gotta take a joke, ladies.
I mean, give me a fucking break. I was like, oh, shit. That's when I really knew, like, I think that that visit was when I really knew. I was like, okay, this is going to be a sit. Like, I'm going to have I'm going to have to make myself watch this movie, but I'm going to make myself watch this movie.
Yeah, yeah. The least we can do is watch it, given that people endured it.
Absolutely.
Another moment that I think worked really well is there's a scene at a hockey game where Charlize is, where a girl, a young woman, like teenager, walks up to Charlize and said that her son is going to go stay at her house. She's introduced herself as her son, as Charlize's son's girlfriend, and says she's going to come stay with me. And Charlize didn't, you know, says, my son has a girlfriend? And like, oh no, he's not, goes racing out into the parking lot and like yanks him out of the car. And he says something like, he calls her a whore, just like everybody says you are. That whole fight scene in that, out in that parking lot, that's a moment where I was not at all aware. I was sort of watching a thing. I'm sort of watching these actors have this moment, and the pain that must inflict, that it clearly inflicted on Charlie's character in that moment, to have her son sort of side with everybody else against her, given all that she's trying to do for him. And I thought that scene worked really well.
Yeah, that was a great moment. I was like, oh my goodness, like this, it's really, shit is really hitting the fan here. Yeah, like, yeah, we're getting it. And then there's a lot of really great shots in that sequence too of the townspeople.
Yes, yes.
Right. And every reaction is priceless. It's like it just varies from shock to like, here we go again, or to like, I told you so, to like, what's going on, to like, I can't believe it. Like, it's just, it's great. That is a great sequence. Yeah, I like that a lot.
And what I liked about it is that I feel like you've seen that move or that scene in a bunch of movies, or like, you know, an overreaction, like a very public fight in a parking lot, especially like at a school or at a hockey game or whatever, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But what's interesting about the way that the movie is set up is that we know that Charlize is in the right here, that she's been blindsided a few times, that she's not this whore that the town thinks she is or everything like that. And I think it's rare that you see the sort of the central battle or whatever. You know that it's actually like a misunderstanding, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like normally you like see it sort of from the outside, be like, oh, like look at like what that, like I don't know what that could be about or whatever. Right. But here you're like, oh no, like that's like, it's all like, nobody understands what's going on except for us and for Charlize.
Right.
Which I just thought was like sort of like an interesting kind of sort of reversal.
Another thing that struck me too is about just how this is like an extremely tight-knit community in a very small town. So like, if you don't hear the gossip at the hairdresser, you're going to hear the gossip at the mine. So I mean, it's very hard to mind your own business, it feels. And I feel like the movie got that across. So like, everybody knows her past. Everybody mm-hmm. knows right. that like she's had these kids and she's unmarried, and then they call her like a lesbian just because she wants to, you know, provide for herself. It's just crazy. Like, everyone is passing judgment on her. And in that scene, it's when she's just like, I don't give a fuck.
Yeah,
you could judge me all you want. Like, it doesn't matter because you're not right. Like, I am in the right here. And so that's a really strong moment. That might be the Oscar moment. I have to go check the Oscars that year and see if that's the clip they showed, but I would have.
I don't have any other notes about the movie. I do have other trivia about the movie, that when in that union meeting that we were talking about before, the heckling was unscripted, which I think is sort of an interesting, daring choice.
Huh.
But it was so authentic, apparently, that Charlize didn't want to know, like, they didn't rehearse that, like, they just shot it. And apparently the crowd was so into it that it took Richard Jenkins 5 minutes to quiet the crowd down.
Wow.
And in that time, Charlize says that she broke out in hives. She said, that was, I think, in my entire career, the most devastating thing I've ever encountered. You know that you are in a movie, right? That you know that you are playing a character, but you also have an entire room full of people playing characters, but also in your brain, it's an entire room of people, like, calling you a whore and, you know, saying, you know, we don't want you here, and, like, that's gonna be terrible. Especially not knowing what they're saying, or, like, what they're gonna say.
I wonder, now that you said that sort of some of the defendants made those cameos at the end, if these are real union members, you know, if they do some shots around the crowd here, and they look like real faces to me at times. And so maybe they were really getting that out for real. You know what I'm saying? Like, if maybe they weren't acting. I don't know. It could have been one of those moments where it just sort of like overtook everything, overtook the production. And it's like, oh shit, like this is what it was must have really been like when she tried to make that speech, because like, we are not getting a word in edgewise, and we can't calm this crowd down. That's kind of crazy.
For all that we've talked at the beginning, that it sort of steals Charlize's moment, it is, that is a really effective scene, though, I think. And the time, you know, it's not 5 minutes in the movie. They've cut it down. You know, as Richard Jenkins is waiting for her to give him the mic. You hear them in the background, and she doesn't know if he's going to like stand up for her or basically take the mic and tell her to go sit down. That's I did think that was really effective, and you do so want Richard Jenkins to turn at that moment. Like, you want him to sort of finally be a good guy, and I think that the tension and timing in that scene worked to the movie's advantage. Again, if only they had allowed her to share that moment a little bit more. But as the moment goes, sort of absent the its place in the movie, it's pretty effective.
While we're talking about Charlize, she was based on Lois Jensen, who started working in the mines in 1975 and endured 13 years of harassment before filing her first lawsuit. So in here, it seems like she's around maybe for a couple weeks or a couple months, possibly.
Right.
But 13 years in real life. It was eventually settled in 1998, 10 years after it was first filed, and over 20 years after the harassment began. By the time Jensen received compensation from the company in 1999, her children were grown and she was too disabled to work. So it took, like, that's the nature of, you know, our legal system, really. It's, you bring something up in 1998 after you, or 1988, it gets settled 11 years later because they just run it out, I guess. Yeah. And then it ultimately, like, it's important and, like, it leads to precedence and stuff. But at the same time, you wish that the women in the moment get some kind of compensation, like, or at least, you know, reform the workplace. Like, who knows what happened, what changed, if things changed, I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, the legislation ends up changing eventually, right? And I guess in the movie they say, like, that's ultimately what they were fighting for. So it sucks that it took so long, but that is, they did win, right? Like, that is a victory. So, I mean, it was worth it, right? Like,
yeah. I would be interested to see a more true to the events take somehow, whether you just come in on it. I'm trying to imagine how you would tell the story. And I think today it might end up being a miniseries, right? You do it over, you know, 10 episodes and cover 10 years of the trial or something. Or, you know, like there'd be a way, I think, the decisions that they made in terms of truncating it here. I can't remember which one of you said it. I think, Mike, it was you. That like they went for the more Hollywood moments when given the choice. And that sort of, I think that does kind of weaken it a little bit. Obviously you have to make choices and you have to change things and things have to be, you have to collapse characters and all that kind of stuff. But you could really feel the collapsing in this movie, especially again in that courtroom scene. And I think that it does a disservice to the story a little bit to do that.
Do you think like it does a disservice to the women, to the actual survivors?
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, I don't know. That's hard for me to speak to from my experience, because you do really feel like there's no question that they've gone through some horrible, horrible things and that they do in some sense come out on top. But I feel like maybe we don't understand quite the sacrifices that they had to make in real life to get that done, in terms of like standing up for themselves through the course of the trial and, you know, choosing to abandon or stay in the jobs or whatever. Like you get kind of nods to that stuff, but it ends up sort of focusing on other things, and I at the expense of some of that probably sacrifice, some of the sacrifice that they had to go through. And as a result, I think, I don't know, not a disservice, but it doesn't paint the picture. I think a different treatment of this material could paint that picture more clearly and maybe more accurately.
And I think what's tough is that the movie really doesn't give a sense of how long this was going on for. I mean, you sort of assume that like it's been going on since they started hiring women. Like at the beginning of the movie, we get that like opening title card or whatever, that, you know, they hired the first female miner in 1975 or whatever, which I guess might have been this Jensen woman. And I don't know how to say this without sort of sounding callous, but like the women who in the movie, the female characters who have been at the mine for a while, are these like older women, these sort of heavier set women, you know, less attractive. Then you bring in Charlize Theron and Michelle Monaghan, are both gorgeous. It sort of like does this weird disservice kind of to...
They movie-fied.
It's like, oh, if you look like a certain kind of woman, you're going to be able to handle it. Like, they're going to bother you, but they're not going to really bother you. But like, if you look like this other kind of woman, then like, if you look like a movie star, then they're really going to bother you. And like, that's the only time the change is going to happen, because you have to have like the courage and the looks to pull this off. Like, just sort of, it sort of feels strange. And I guess that goes back to what Mike was saying, what you just brought up again, Tobin, with like Hollywoodification of a kind of story like this.
Yeah, I guess maybe it's like beauty washing in a way, right? Like, you bring in like the beautiful star to play the central role, so everyone pays attention and they want to look at them, so they'll keep paying attention and everything. And I guess that is a little less credible ultimately if that's, but I mean, that again, that's unfortunate. That's Hollywood. And I mean, for me, the main point is that the movie got made at all. I think that is a huge victory in and of itself. Like, this movie could come out tomorrow, right, and be just as, like, important. Like, these issues, like, yeah, there's legislation and all, but these things are still happening, like, hardcore. Like, we hear about this shit every day, and it's like, the more things change, the more they stay the same. So, in a way, I want to say, like, it's too bad that they had to, like, wash some of this a little bit to make it go down easier. But on the other hand, I want to say, like, at least it got out there, and at least there's a version of it that we can see, and I was affected by it, at least.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, right. No matter how sort of, I mean, I'm assuming it's mostly true to life, whether how true to life it is, we know that the women were in the courtroom scene at the end. Charlize spent time with some of them to get to know them personally, and she said, she spent as much time as I possibly could with the women. They don't wallow in self-pity, they're survivors. So whether or not the story was Hollywoodified, or whether it was simplified, which we obviously know it was, I think, like you're saying, Mike, that they have to just be happy and proud that not only were they able to eventually achieve this, like, legal victory, but they're also able to, like, tell this story and sort of share it with the world, anchored by a woman who had just won an Oscar a couple years before. So that's, it's good that it happened.
Right. I'm glad this movie exists, for sure.
My last little bit of trivia is that during the fight scene, Woody Harrelson actually swung at Chris Mulkey and accidentally broke his nose.
Oh, no.
Which is why there's no shot of Mulkey's face at the end, probably, because he's probably all bloody, or maybe just not even on set anymore. Oh. So
they should have just worked that into the movie. Like, that character was such an asshole, like, deserved a broken nose.
Now, Tobin, do you have any other notes, any other thoughts about North Country before we try to get into this game that, like, we're gonna have to explain this game and sort of very slowly explain it every time these next 10 episodes, Mike, but any other thoughts or notes about this movie, Tobin?
One last thing is that the first clue that I had watching this movie that we were in for maybe not quite as sophisticated a take on this material as I had hoped for. Sophisticated is maybe not quite the right word. Not the choices in terms of the material, how they treat the material, that I hoped for. She sees, like, this dead deer pass on the back of a trailer at the beginning of the movie, which felt like maybe the most heavy-handed piece of imagery at the beginning of a movie possible. And I don't still even quite understand what it meant. Like, is she the deer? Or I don't know what she was.
I love that this has thrown you into a quandary.
I don't know. Because it feels like it really is. She's staring at this thing as it passes the gas station. It feels like she really is being asked to be read, and I have no clue. So that tells me pretty early that, like,
we're all the deer,
yeah,
Tobin.
Maybe
we
that's what it is.
We're all the deer.
But I think, no, it was just saying, oh, dear.
Mike, any other thoughts or notes about this, or do you want to end on that comedy bang bang joke?
I just want to say Anita Hill.
Yeah.
I remember that shit. So, like, that was a little weird. I mean, I think that helped more just to sort of settle me in what year we were. She says once or twice, like, Anita Hill, Anita Hill. But I was like, I don't feel like anyone around her understood what she meant by that necessarily. But, like, that was kind of interesting to see that come through.
There's also at one point the Charlize's boss, when she goes to meet with him, like the intermediate boss before, you know, the top guy who's like, hey, if you have any problems, come to me. And then he eventually says, like, oh, we can just, you know, accept your resignation with no 2 weeks notice. But her intermediate boss has, like, a penthouse or whatever pinup calendar on the wall that has a very big 1990 on it. So, like, there's, like, sort of not so subtle ways of, like, hey, here's where we are. Okay. So, Tobin.
Yeah.
The first 10 episodes of the show, we played a recast game where we recast the main characters if we were remaking this today. Mike and I got burned out by that. We stopped that game.
Yeah.
The next 10 episodes, we did a pitch a sequel game, which I don't know how you would do a sequel North Country 2, more north, I guess. But we also got burned out on that, too. So now, our new game, and again, with dark movies like this, Mike, I don't know how we're going to do it. We are going to try to establish the unified vision of Charlize Theron.
Ooh.
We're going to take 5 random movies, and if you haven't seen some of them, or if you don't know anything about some of them, we can swap them out for others.
Okay.
We're going to take 4 plus this one, and try to connect them all, all of our characters, connect all the stories.
Interesting. Okay.
Sort of establish a Charlize universe throughout 5 random movies.
I love it.
And
okay.
If you've seen 5, we can do 5 you've seen, as long as we haven't covered them yet. So we're only doing ones we've covered so far.
Okay.
We're going to take this one for 1. I'm also going to, we're going to just randomly pick five. And again, if you haven't seen these, we can skip them. But the ones that we have are, not going to do Hollywood Confidential, I can tell you that, because that's a TV movie that no one has seen. The Legend of Bagger Vance.
Yep.
Waking Up in Reno.
Never seen it.
Okay, we're gonna undo that one.
I think I've only seen four other ones. Let me tell you.
The Devil's Advocate.
Yeah, I've seen The Devil's Advocate. Yep.
The Astronaut's Wife.
I've seen The Astronaut's Wife.
Wow. Okay, cool.
And have you seen Celebrity, the Woody Allen movie?
Yes, in the theater.
So there we go.
Oh, okay. No.
Well, I was a Kenneth Branagh fan, a huge Kenneth Branagh, in high school, wasn't that? So, yeah. Anyway,
I'm amazed I'm still a Kenneth Branagh fan after watching that movie recently.
I defended him so much after that movie, and seeing it again, I was like, oh boy, I was an addict.
So we are going to try to connect, try to link, try to intertwine The Devil's Advocate, Celebrity, The Astronaut's Wife, The Legend of Bagger Vance, and North Country. So we have three in modern day. We have Legend of Bagger Vance in the 30s, maybe? And we have this one in the early to mid-90s. So the big question is, how do we get from The Legend of Bagger Vance to modern day, essentially? Just throwing it out there for anyone to answer.
And so are we doing this through, like, the characters in the movie or the people who behind the movie?
Characters in the movie. It's just sort of what the movie's about, the characters in the movie, time that they take place, all that sort of stuff.
Right, like as if...
Text to text.
It's not like The 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Okay. Got it. Which I always had to play with directors and screenwriters and stuff because I could never do actors.
We could also do that as a possibility. I don't know how to... Although I guess everything would be like, Charlize was in this movie and Charlize was also in this movie.
Right.
Or we could just exclude Charlize from it. But yeah, okay. Right. But yeah, no, I got what we see on screen.
As far as all these movies are concerned, Bagger Vance, that tournament actually happened. You know, like it's a connected universe.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay, got it.
Who was the guy who played old Matt Damon in Bagger Vance? Was that Jack Lemmon? That was his last uncredited. Okay.
Okay, so maybe that's how we connect that one. Well, so I think the easiest connection is North Country, The Devil's Advocate, in that they're lawyers. That Woody Harrelson, after winning this landmark case, resumes his law career and goes down to the Deep South, from the North Country to the Deep South, and meets up with a young upstart lawyer named Keanu Reeves, and the two of them have their own law firm together before Keanu leaves and goes to New York.
Holy
so we have
shit.
Two of those
That's
links.
Amazing.
That's good. Yeah, okay. Good.
I have kind of a weak link, but...
there's no weak links, Mike. There's all strong links.
In Bagger Vance, Charlize is like a super wealthy person who throws the golf tournament in order to save her country club. She had a granddaughter, I guess? Her granddaughter grew up to be North Country. Like, her grandmother grew up to be North Country, goes there and wins the case. Since she, like, decided after she won the case, she needs to take a break and get away from all this snow. So she goes down to Florida and runs into a young lawyer that she becomes affiliated with. And maybe that's how she gets connected to Devil's Advocate. I don't know if that goes in order, though. Are we trying to go from...
I still don't fully understand the game as we play it. We're still working out the kinks, which I think is fine. I just don't understand. What do you mean grows up to be North Country?
The girl from North Country. There's Charlize, like, so...
Like, so, it's her...
So
yeah,
she's
like,
a descendant.
Yeah, it's like her descendant. That's why they look alike.
The family loses all the money, and she ends up sort of... Like, her Sissy Spacek is the granddaughter or whatever of the Bagger Vance lady, and they've lost all their money, right? So she moves up to Minnesota and marries Richard Jenkins, and they have Charlize, right?
Okay.
Right.
Okay. Yep. So we tied in Bagger Vance to this movie, which then ties into Devil's Advocate. We need to work in Celebrity, which is not at all related to this, and also The Astronaut's Wife, which is about aliens.
Okay, so this is cool, though, because, so Charlize in North Country stays there, and it's Woody Harrelson that goes to Florida and runs into her doppelganger, right? Like, that's...
Oh!
What, yeah. Okay, cool.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay, because I remember previously we've had her character continue, and then just someone who looks like her be in the same city or something.
Yeah, Tobin, the two big things, the two big crutches that we've relied on in this movie, in this game, and so far again today, is granddaughters and grandmothers and doppelgangers.
So if Woody Harrelson is the one that goes down and finds her doppelganger in Devil's Advocate, then the actual Charlize character from North Country, who's the great-granddaughter of the Bagger Vance lady, because the pressures in the community is so hostile to her now, even though she's winning the case, that... she ends up having to she cuts her hair really short, changes her name and moves away, and like maybe leaves the kids with Sissy Spacek and Richard Jenkins and marries Johnny Depp.
Oh, okay.
So it's like her in witness protection, you know what I mean? Like she like abandons her life and reinvents herself and it's like has no past,
and that's
right?
And that's why she really wants kids, yes, because right. she was a mom who gave up her kids.
Right.
That's much better. I was going to go with Johnny Depp shows up and says he's the real father and that her kids are alien babies, but I like yours. I like the whole, got to get away from this place.
And then at some point, they go to the video store and they rent Celebrity on DVD, directed by Woody Allen.
Yes.
Oh, no. Well, I think we might have linked Devil's Advocate with Celebrity previously, where she goes to New York City with Keanu, but instead of succumbing to the deadly sins of the devil,
she
breaks from him and becomes a hot model and parties all night long and goes overseas to Paris or whatever.
Isn't she like she in Celebrity? Isn't she the thing is she can like she every her whole body's an erogenous zone? Isn't that
how
thing?
Do you remember that?
Yes.
Well, I saw it when I was like I don't know, was I 20? I mean, I don't know. Stuck in my head. So here's the idea: is that her interactions with the devil in The Devil's Advocate change her into someone who is like change this doppelganger into someone whose entire body is an erogenous zone, right? So like it's through that sort of like that's like her curse or whatever, right? And so then it's the doppelganger who ends up being in Celebrity who has this new quote unquote superpower,
right? Yes, Woody Harrelson meets in Florida, right?
Exactly.
When he goes
right.
down there. Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Perfect.
Yep. And that's like perfect. So instead of going insane and killing herself, she like accepts the power and controls yes. it and then goes right. out and becomes like a crazy model person. Okay.
Exactly. Exactly.
Love it. No plot holes. Everything makes total perfect sense.
Well, I say it every time. I'm not sure if it's a game, but I always have fun doing this.
Yeah. It's super cool. Okay, the last thing that we do on this show is nominate this for the Watch the Throne Awards, the Charlize Theron Golden Wallpapers, maybe, the Golden Teeth. Who knows? So we have Best Film, Worst Film. Don't think this qualifies for either one. Best of the Worst, no. Wildly Inconsistent Tone, no. Craziest Ending, no. Best Charlize Role. I think we probably have to nominate this for mm-hmm. that.
Yeah, yeah. She's good in this.
Josie Ames.
Yeah, like all things aside, like she really is like awesome in this role. She definitely deserved that nomination, I think. Not just her, but there's just like some extremely subtle acting moments, like whether it be Jenkins or Jeremy Renner or Charlize, where like I don't know, I just feel like the situation in the scene can just explode at any moment or something. So like everybody is playing it really well, like whether they're on edge or they're right on the line or something. So
you know what's weird? I just thought of this. I don't know if it's a missed opportunity or I'm glad that it didn't happen, but when they're at that karaoke bar and they're all dancing, she's dancing to Hit Me With Your Best Shot, which I'm going to add into the best dancing category because it's tracking all of her dancing scenes in movies. But then Jeremy Renner gets on the microphone and starts singing, and I was like, oh, here comes the scene, like here comes like this, you know, confrontation or whatever, like he's going to do some weird shit, and nothing happens. And I was like, oh, huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I really appreciated that moment because it's like he's just, yeah, he can just contain himself, you know.
Let's see here. What else? Most wasted performance, no. Manic Pixie Dream Girl, no. Sexist film, no. I mean, it's sexist in its subject matter, but not in like the actual construction of the film.
Right, I know, right. It doesn't, it's not in what the category was designed for.
Best character transformation. I mean, she does transform, but not from like victim to alien in The Astronaut's Wife or from pure to dead inside in The Devil's Advocate, so we're going to skip that.
Yeah, and I also feel like she made like a declaration to herself really early on in the movie where it's like, I'm changing.
Yeah.
I don't really feel like she changed as much as she overcame or something.
Right. She changes the world around her.
Yeah.
I am going to add in best accent/voice for Minnesota, yeah? So that's that for sure.
Oh, you know what just came into my mind? We were sort of referring to this as the Rosie the Riveter movie for some reason when we had no idea what it was about. And it like
She's wearing a bandana in a lot of the promotional pictures for this.
Yeah. But like it just occurred to me, like it turned out to be like the furthest thing from a Rosie the Riveter type movie, really. I mean, that's a whole different story, but anyway, I just thought that just occurred to me.
There's no love story or love triangle we can skip that. She does not die. There's no other deaths other than, you know, there's no deaths in this movie from nobody. dies in this movie. I mean, Frances McDormand is almost dead.
Yeah, almost. Yeah, yeah.
Best fight, no. Best. So is there a line that she says that we want to note?
Yes. I got a bunny. When she's doing the UFO catcher at the bar, like the crane machine.
And oh, she's like, I got get a bunny, the bunny, I got get the bunny.
And then she like screams it, I got a bunny. I thought you'd like that line.
Best freak out, no. Cinematography, no. Song, no. Score soundtrack, no.
Dancing, well, you don't want to do hit me with your best shot for song.
Well, dancing too. It's not like really. Hit me with your best shot.
Okay, yeah, yeah. That's better represented there. Because there isn't like a song called North Country that Bruce Springsteen's singing or anything.
And then do we want to nominate men or women for best or worst actor or actress other than Charlize? Who else? Richard Jenkins.
Richard Jenkins, I think you can't overlook him in this movie.
I think Francis too, but that's again, we haven't had like a ton of
we can put her in
supporting
here.
Female roles, but I feel like she represents a lot here.
We have been coming together. What I also do like, before I finish my thought, I'm just all over the place. What I do like is that Sean Bean and Frances McDormand don't have last names. They're just Kyle and Glory. Everybody else has real names. They're just Kyle and Glory. Like, it's just like, okay.
Yeah, that couple, like, when you look a little closer, is actually, like, pretty tragic. Like, they don't have kids, and I got the sense they can't. He ends up saying he only has the one ball, you know?
But so it works. It works.
It works, but it doesn't, they can't have, they don't have any children, so, I don't know. And then she ends up stricken.
But is it because of him or is it because of her ALS?
We don't know. I mean, that's the thing. Like, it's probably just the coupling.
Yeah.
He is really good in this movie, Sean Bean. It's like under the radar performance. You know, he allows her to be the, like, Frances McDormand gets the showy role, and he really underplays his scenes in a I think a really sort of noble way.
And I was like, in 5 years you're gonna be Ned Stark, and then in 5 1/4 years you're no longer gonna be Ned Stark.
Yes.
There's something really interesting too, the fact that he was like a watchmaker, you know, that he didn't work in the mines, and you know, that wasn't weighing on him, I guess, right? Just that his vocation was completely different. It just, and he carried himself completely
differently.
He could
escape that life.
Yeah, yeah. And he's just much more tempered man and stuff. Yeah, this is a very interesting role in contrast to the rest of the guys portrayed in the movie.
What I do want to say, though, Mike, is that we haven't had a ton of female representation, but now, through 24 movies, we are up to 5 best female actress role. We got Christina Ricci from Monster, Dakota Fanning from Trapped, which, I mean, is sort of maybe a little bit of a stretch, but she's fine in that movie. Frances McDormand in this movie, Helen Hunt in The Curse of the Jade Scorpion, which, ugh, can't believe we nominated that movie for something good. Yeah. And then, of course, my heart, Natasha Richardson as Darlene in Waking Up in Reno.
Oh,
which,
yeah.
Mike, do you have anything to say about Waking Up in Reno?
No, the apology tour has ended. I think I covered every podcast at this point, but I've made my peace.
We have not nominated any women for worst female non-Charlize actress role. We have 7 different men nominated for worst, and 7 different men nominated for best as of now, but none for worst non-Charlize actress or role. So
there's a really great performance, and I don't know the woman's name, but the lawyer for the corporation.
Oh, yes, yes.
That was insane. Like, I should know that person's name and go watch all of her movies now, because, like, that is a fucking tough role right there. And
do you think I hired you because you're the smartest lawyer? No, you're the smartest woman lawyer. I'm like, whoa, okay.
So, I mean, I was going to say, like, I want to nominate that for worst role because that person is despicable, but, like, I also want to say, like, best actress because she played it perfectly.
And she's in The Nick, I would add, since we did...
What?
She's Anne Chickering in The Nick.
Oh.
Isn't she the one who passes away from the tumor?
Bertie's mom, right?
Huh.
Yeah. And she's in The Big Sick. She's the one of the doctors. There's Dr. Cunningham, which I remember pretty clearly from that movie. She's in a million things. She's great. She's really, really good. Yeah.
Shout out The Big Sick. Cool. Any other thoughts? Any other... before we do that, any other things that this movie was so good or bad that we want to nominate or create a new category for, or no?
If you're running out, I'm sorry, maybe this is not my place to say, but if you find yourself running out of, like, oh my God, there's so many, if you have too many performances, you could do best couple, because I feel like you could knock out both Sean Bean and Frances McDormand. I'm not sure you have a bunch of other couples
that's,
in your movies.
That's not bad. I don't think we have any, do we have any couple?
Like, I like that idea. The only problem I have is whether or not those couples should or should not, or maybe it's 2 different categories, couples with Charlize and couples without Charlize, you know, because
I guess I'm thinking about supporting couples. Yeah, couples without Charlize.
Which, I don't know if we've had.
Yeah.
Because the problem, and I mean, like, really the problem that we've talked about a lot, and this is a bigger problem with movies, is that there's not a lot of movies where there's another prominent actress. Like, if Charlize is in the movie, it's rare that there's another woman who is as on much screen enough
yeah,
to true. Be recognized,
yeah. No, that makes
right?
sense. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah,
this is rare in that there's another woman. There's a bunch of different women. Like Michelle Monaghan is also in this movie more than like most other Charlize movies have a supporting woman in them.
More than like Liv Tyler is in like That Thing You Do, and she's like the main woman aside from Charlize in that movie.
I do like the idea of a couple, but I just don't think that we have enough other, like, I'm just
yeah.
looking at
no,
the other
yeah.
women that we've nominated, or the other men that we've nominated, or whatever, let's see here. Cuba Gooding, like, his girlfriend on screen is not in it very much. Joaquin Phoenix is sort of kind of with, is with Charlize. Keanu is with Charlize. Richard Jenkins is from this movie, which I guess we could nominate him in Sissy Spacek, so we could have just two couples from this movie. De Niro is with Charlize. Stanley Tucci in The Life and Death of Peter Sellers just plays Stanley Kubrick. He's only on screen for like 2 minutes.
He's amazing.
And then Tom Hanks is
with that football player, the guy...
Howie Long.
Howie yeah. Long is his partner in That Thing You Do in the extended cut, which is incredible.
Right. Helen Hunt is with Woody Allen, which we're not going to nominate that. And then we could do Natasha Richardson and Billy Bob Thornton. But,
both couples from that movie, I mean.
Yeah. I do really like that idea, but I just think that, based on the way that Hollywood is, doesn't really work. So.
No, it makes sense.
Any other thoughts about North Country before we wrap up?
I don't think there's a novelization for this of all the movies out there, so I won't be reading that. If there were, I don't think I even would be.
Good to know. So. Good to know. Tobin will be back in 3 movies for In the Valley of Ela. We will find out how to pronounce it on June 1st. So come back for that. In between now and then, though, we have Aeon Flux, which I feel like could not be, knowing really nothing about it, could not be farther from this movie. And
did you watch any cartoons yet? Can you try and check out like at least
I need
a
you to send me links. If you send me links, I'll watch them.
I mean, you find out, you can find anything online.
Not going to remember to do it.
Okay, I'll
problem.
Send you, I'll go check out YouTube. I'll send you a couple of the early ones if I can find them.
It's kind of cool you guys are doing back-to-back women directors, though. That's great.
Who did Aeon Flux?
Karen Kusama.
Okay,
Kusama.
Cool.
Yeah.
And then, also super cool, before Tobin comes back, we're going to do Charlize's 5-episode run of Arrested Development, Mr. F. So,
for British eyes only.
There we go. So a couple cool things coming up, and then we have Tobin's episode, and then we have a very special crossover episode. Going to leave it at that.
Da-da-da.
After that. So... Tobin, thank you so much for being on here. You have your own podcast with Aislinn. Aislinn's not on any... Does Aislinn want to talk about Charlize?
She sure might.
I feel like Aislinn just does not respond to me when I email her. Sometimes she does.
Email is hard for her, yeah. You should...
Twitter
you
is should, also hard for
Twitter's,
her.
Write her a letter.
Harder than
I mean,
email.
Just snail mail.
I'll put in a word for you.
Yeah, find out, because, I mean, you guys are going to be on a very special episode of the Fast and Furious, Too Fast, Too Forever,
yes.
coming up very soon.
Yes,
but we'd
we
love
are.
To have Aislinn on here, but you do a podcast with your sister Aislinn called The Contenders, which this also sort of gave me a little bit of flashbacks in some ways to The Contender, where we have Charlize on the stand. Tell us a little bit. I mean, we've talked about your podcast on a handful of episodes here already, but tell our listeners a little bit about your podcast.
Yeah, so our podcast, as you have mentioned, is about films made by and or starring women who refuse to play by the rules. Women directors and movies with strong female characters in the central role. And we sort of are all over the map. And you've done everything from Wonder Woman to Zero Dark Thirty. So we are we come out every 2 weeks. And yeah, definitely come check us out. Joey has been on an episode. Mike is going to be on an upcoming episode. Well, by the time this comes out, you can find an episode where our dad was our guest, which is very fun. He was on for the movie Hidden Figures. So yeah, come check us out. We're called the Contenders. Yeah,
the Hidden Figures episode was last week as you're listening to this. And what's coming up next week?
Okay, I gotta look it up.
Didn't mean to put you on the spot like that.
That's all right. Just open my little file here.
Oh, also, while you're thinking about that, today, as this episode comes out, on May 11th, North Country, May 11th, on VOD today is a movie called Revenge, which is written and directed by Coralie Fargeot, who follows me on Twitter because I love her movie so much, starring Matilda Lutz, who is a model. It's a rape revenge movie that I desperately want to cover, talk about on The Contenders, because it really subverts the genre. I don't know that Aislinn would really appreciate this movie, so maybe it won't happen.
Wow. And all I want to talk about is Supergirl, so like we couldn't be further from each other.
If you like strong movies about strong women and also are not really squeamish and want to see like a really bloody badass movie that made people faint at Fantastic Fest, check out Revenge on VOD today. I love it. It was my second favorite movie last year, behind only The Big Sick, which we've already talked about. I love this movie. So, today, your homework. You can watch North Country, but like we were saying, it's sort of a tough ask. Watch Revenge, because Revenge rules. So, watch Revenge, please. Thank you.
And this episode, the one we're recording right now, you say comes out on May 11th?
Yes. So last week was Hidden Figures, and next week is...
Next week, Mike is going to be joining us for Winter's Bone.
Oh.
Deborah Granik movie starring Jennifer Lawrence, which if people have not seen, they absolutely should. I wish Deborah Granik had made North Country. I think that that aesthetic applied to the North Country story could have been fantastic. So yeah, come listen to our episode.
And actually, one other thing I want to say is that Jennifer Lawrence came from the part of the world that Winter's Bone is set in. Mm-hmm. And one thing that was about this movie was that Charlize grew up in a similar blue-collar community in South Africa as it was in this movie. And so she was sort of familiar with the type of people and the type of community and stuff. So she was able to sort of draw on that too. So it's always cool when we can point out when her background, when her childhood, when her history shows up in movies. So that's a little bit of a thing right there.
Awesome.
For all things Watch a Throne and all things The Contenders and all things everything, you can go to cageclub.me or facebook.com/cageclub or at cageclubpod on Twitter. You can find all of our episodes. This was episode 24. We are now officially more than halfway done, unless she sneaks any others in there, aside from Gringo and Tully from 2018. We are more than halfway done now. We are going to finish up sometime in October-ish, I believe. So we are not that far from finishing. Closer to the end than the beginning. Thank you for listening so far, and we hope that you keep listening still. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And that was Tobin Addington, and we'll see you next time on Watch the Throne.